Is it an idea that's just a boring, or is it one that's going to die in its crib? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst, and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Great to be back with you on this fall day. This is our program for Saturday, November 3rd, 2018. Sweet. That is the Saturday before the 2018 election. So things are heating up, and I don't know about you, but I'm looking forward to Wednesday because there will no longer be election ads on.
Tell me about it.
When I turn on YouTube, I will not be admonished to either vote early for the Democrat in the local congressional race or vote early to stamp out the scourge of Nancy Pelosi and company.
But you need to do those things, Chuck.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
Come on.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they're mutually exclusive, so they can't both be done.
That's sadly true.
Yes. I can't both vote for Danny O'Connor and vote no on Danny O'Connor.
The people do it all the time. Come on, Chuck. I mean, all you have to do is go to the local graveyard and look up a name that's been dead for at least 60 or 70 years, so most of the records aren't there, and go in and cast your provisional ballot that way.
Well, it doesn't matter.
Folks, I'm not advocating that.
Yeah,
I'm
right.
Just saying, yes, that's the way
it
things
does
happen.
Sometimes. Yeah, then you can have the Secretary of State explain why there are people with birth dates of 1867 on the active voter rolls. And
exactly. But those are placeholders.
Those were markers.
So when they were like reviewing, that was how they held their mark, so they knew what they'd already reviewed. Don't you know? That was the explanation we got for that.
What a bunch of nonsense.
It's like, okay, come on. You got caught with your hands in the cookie jar, or worse, you got caught with your head somewhere hiding because you hadn't paid any attention to the fact that you had active voter rolls that were physically impossible to have been a voter.
Well, just to reiterate, we don't normally endorse candidates here, and I'm not going to do that. However, issues are nonpartisan, and
yes,
I'm going. You and I are both in the same boat in opposing the passage of issue one.
That is true, and honestly, Chuck, it's very interesting. I'm glad you brought issue one up, because we want to talk about that first before we talk about some of the other things that may impact elections next week. But folks, if you're paying any attention whatsoever, state issue one, we've talked about it before on the program. We had an entire program on the program about this. And it's just the longer it goes, the more likely it is that this is basically been a complete setup by progressive leftists to legalize drugs.
Well, beyond that is to create chaos.
It doesn't say that in the amendment, but the more you read into it, the more you realize, I read some analyses here from some folks, from legal scholars and others, who basically said that, the way this is worded, you know, you could be carrying a kilo of marijuana around, and as long as you said it was for personal use, the worst you could get is a misdemeanor and probation, just like the amendment says. So, that's bad in and of itself, and of course, today, which we're recording this on the 1st of November, but today the Right to Life Action Coalition of Ohio, which, you know, full disclosure, I'm their lobbyist. We voted, our executive committee voted to endorse a no vote on issue one and come out. So we're as far as I can tell, we're the only pro-life coalition who's decided that reducing the likelihood of people carrying around illegal drugs and using them is a pro-life issue because it's a family issue. You know, the use of controlled substances destroys families. It hurts communities. And, you know, we believe it's a pro-life position to say no on issue one, not only for that reason, but also because we see our board sees that allowing this use and possession of illegal drugs could impact the abortion debate as well. You know, Chuck, for a long time, Ohio had said that a certain drug, RU-486, was illegal to use for abortions. But the problem was that way back when, they tied that whole concept to FDA approval. And, of course, what happened in the Obama administration 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Well, Obama's FDA all of a sudden, you know, decided, and I'm sure with no outside influence or pressure whatsoever, that the use of RU-486 to commit abortion was an okay practice. That they basically made it an on-label usage for the drug, which basically, by effect, invalidated Ohio's ban on it. And to this point, it's been difficult to try to get, you know, unless the FDA changes their mind in the Trump administration, which could happen, and we hope it does happen. You know, what you're going to have is that this drug, and as we've seen, there have been you know, Founders in Columbus, which was the abortion clinic, they closed their doors and they reopened as a what they call a medical only, which means that they don't do surgical procedures right now, but what they do is they write scripts for the abortion drug, RU-486, because they can do it now because it's not banned anymore under Ohio law. But if we would go to try to, let's say issue one passed, and we go to ban abortion drugs like methotrexate, mifepristone, other cocktails that are used to influence abortion, well, Chuck, if they became controlled substances and the provision that of possessing or using that particular drug or distributing that drug became less than a felony three, it was a four or five, well, then a woman could have that drug, take it and use it, and have an abortion illegally, and the worst that could happen to her would be a misdemeanor offense with probation as the only recourse for the courts.
Not in Alabama.
Not in Alabama, but in Ohio.
Yeah,
because
I know.
That's what we're dealing with in Ohio. So we see that as a major pro-life issue. You know, and some would argue, well, no, this is only about, like, you know, like opiates and that. It's like, no, if you read the amendment language correctly, it basically is any kind of a controlled substance. As long as the possession of it isn't a third or higher degree felony from the start, and most times just possession is either a first degree misdemeanor or it's a fifth or a fourth degree felony, depending on how much you have. Well, under the amendment, all that would be considered, you can't do anything more than give a person probation, and they get reclassified all as misdemeanors. So the Right to Life Action Coalition is coming out and saying, we don't think that's a pro-life position to take because we can see this being abused, and we also see a liberal judges in Ohio, not that we have any, Chuck, in Ohio.
All
Tim
right.
Black, Algernon Marbley, Susan Dott. I can keep going down the list of liberal judges we have in Ohio, including maybe a couple on our state Supreme Court. That we can see that it might end up harming pro-life laws because of the way it's worded. So we're taking a no position on it, and I believe we're the only pro-life organization in Ohio that has taken a pro-life position on this and said vote no on issue one. So there you go. I mean, not just for the issues with incarceration and what law enforcement is saying and everything else, you know, we're saying vote no on issue one because we believe it's not a pro-life position to take to support this.
Okay, I grasp that, because let's face it, RU-486 is bad news, and it's also, you know, everybody thinks it's an easy way out. It's toxic as anything. It's bad news stuff. So as usual, now, if you want to see disingenuousness at work, Cincinnati.com, it's the local newspaper, the Cincinnati Inquirer, basically has an article that talks about fact and fiction in on issue one, separating Frack from Fishu, from fiction on the drug ballot. They're sort of poo-pooing the idea that this would allow drug dealers out on the street. And I read the reasoning, and boy, is it badly reasoned. Terribly reasoned.
Oh, it is. Absolutely.
Would Ohio Issue 1 reduce penalties for drug dealers? Put simply, no. Yeah, it would. Put more complicatedly, Ohio Issue 1 would not change penalties for people convicted of trafficking in drugs. Okay, that's a technicality. And those caught using a first, second, or third degree amount of drugs would still face prison for drug possession. Don't think so. The argument is anyone with that many drugs must be sharing them or selling them. However, prosecutors and GOP politicians argue that a fourth degree felony amount of drugs is still a lot of drugs, which it is. Anyone found with that many drugs might be selling them as well. For example, nearly 1 kilogram, of marijuana, yes, would be enough for 3,000 blunts if each was a third of a gram.
Okay. If I remember correctly, a kilogram is what, about a little over 2 pounds?
2.2 right? pounds.
2.2 pounds of marijuana.
That's a lot of dope, dude.
It is. It's a huge amount of marijuana. And Chuck, as you know, Ohio has done some things here in the last couple of years where we have decided that it's okay to, on a limited basis, for only for medical use only, to legalize marijuana. But what this amendment would basically do is, oh, hey, you can have 2.2 pounds of pot, not not have the medical card and not have any kind of the paperwork or authorization. And the worst you could get is a misdemeanor and probation. So,
yeah,
this is a way to legalize recreational pot. What's going to happen?
That's exactly what it is. Believe me, 2.2 pounds of marijuana is that's a lot of marijuana. A lot. And 20 grams of fentanyl, which is also is a lot of fentanyl. I mean, at normal strength, 2 milligrams is essentially pretty close to a fatal dose.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 milligrams, well, versus 20 grams, multiply that by 10,000, that 2 milligrams, by 10,000, yes, and you're at 20 grams.
Yes, that's right.
So you're allowed to carry around 10,000 lethal doses. And
a fentanyl, yeah,
a fentanyl for a fourth or fifth degree. This is an absurd law. Look, the purpose of this law is to create chaos. It's the Gramsci method. If you don't know what we're talking about Antonio Gramsci, who basically said you have to tear society down from the inside and rebuild it.
That's right. The long march through the institutions.
Long march through the institutions, and this is part of the plan.
Yes. Now, I find it interesting, Chuck, because we talked about this before, $4.5 million was spent to get on the ballot, and it was mainly coming from two of George Soros's foundations,
yep,
and two of Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook's foundations.
Yep.
Pumping their money in. Now, we found out I was on a call with the No on Issue One folks. And they described that as they're finding out, and of course they won't know for sure exactly how much until after the election, because that's the way our campaign finance laws work, is they won't get the final reports on how much money they spent on the other side until after the election. But according to their estimation, the pro issue one folks have spent $10 million on television ads.
And they're only ahead at this point by 3 points.
Okay. Well, that's the whole point, Chuck. Those ads were all bought ahead of time, and of course, at the beginning of October, issue one was leading in the polls by 17 points. It was like 53 to 37 or something.
Right.
I forget exactly what the low end number was, 38 maybe. As of the beginning of this week, which was the end of October, it's up by 3 points. It has lost 14 points in the last month because people have woken up and the opposition campaign has gotten fired up. They got rolling. Pretty much almost every newspaper in the state has come out editorializing against issue one. Pretty much every law enforcement agency, local government association that you can think of, the Ohio Christian Alliance, Citizens for Community Values, and now the Right to Life Action Coalition have all come out and said, folks, for the love of all that's holy, please do not let this thing become part of our Constitution. Because that's the other big problem, Chuck. This isn't a statute. This is a constitutional amendment that basically cannot be changed short of spending tens of millions of dollars on another constitutional amendment. So, you know, this is Soros and Zuckerberg and company wanting to buy Ohio's laws in order to push radical legalization of drugs.
Yeah, exactly. That is what this is also a kind of a workup to see what techniques will work in the 2020 elections to where they got to put the right amount of money and how they've got to present the case. And right now, I mean, they got a leg up on it, which they like to do. They like to get a leg up on it, but they haven't been able to keep the leg up. And there's a reason for that, because everybody's looking at it and we've all seen the ads if we've been watching television at all. It's the drug company's fault because my son committed suicide with heroin died of an overdose. Did he commit suicide? Not intentionally, but yes.
Not intentionally. Yeah. An accidental self elimination.
Well, my question is, since when are drug companies selling heroin? And the answer is they're not. The point they're trying to make is that it's the drug company's fault that people got addicted to oxycodone and switched over to heroin because it was easier to get. No, ma'am, that's incorrect. Whose fault is it when a person gets addicted to a pain medication? And we all understand why, you know, people have chronic pain or pain from surgeries and longstanding injuries and that kind of thing. I'm a chronic pain sufferer. I have had pain in parts of my body for the last 37 years. What do I do about it? Well, when it gets really bad, I'll take an ibuprofen or some MSM to take the edge off it. Have I ever gotten involved in using pain medication? No, I have not. In fact, I've avoided it when I've had surgery. You know, you can't avoid it. I've had chronic pain for the last 37 years due to a car accident, and I began refusing pain medication as quickly as I could in the hospital, and they were a little shocked. They said most people are more than happy to get. And I said, yeah, I like the feeling, but what I don't like is the idea that I'm going to get addicted to that feeling. And so I started, you know, as soon as I could stand it, I quit taking painkillers, and they were a little amazed. And I have a high pain threshold, but I get it. You can get addicted to those things. Look, what do you do to avoid this kind of thing, this addiction to drugs? And you can see it in famous people like Rush Limbaugh was addicted to oxycodone. Why? He had chronic low back pain. What do you do? Do you go over to heroin? No, you get help and get out from under the beast. And I understand that in an addict's mindset that's not necessarily the first thing you do, but you cannot blame the drug companies because they sold pain pills, or pain medication of any kind. Whose fault is it? The doctor is supposed to monitor you. The pharmacist is supposed to monitor you. Did that happen in this woman's son's case? The answer is no. He decided to self-medicate because the doctors actually did cut him off and said, you can't have the pain medication anymore. You're addicted. What did he do? He went out and self-medicated. That is not the doctor's fault. That is not the drug company's fault. That is her son's fault. And sitting there and saying that, if only we'd had this law, then he would not have died. The logic does not hold. In fact, he would have been better off had he been caught and gone to jail. Why? Because he could have gotten treatment.
Treatment.
That, because most treatment programs require that you be convicted of possession or intoxication as a prerequisite for getting that kind of help. Is that necessarily the smart way to go? The way to handle this problem is to get treatment for people. And this law does nothing to do that. This law just simply cuts penalties. The big line is that education and treatment is the answer to this problem. Yeah, it is, but the only way you're going to get that is if you convict individuals of possession. And you're not going to be able to do that with this. Oh, yeah, you get a 3 strikes and you're out with a huge amount of drugs before mm-hmm. you have to go. So this is just a bad plan overall. It's just awful. We see that. But it's not the only thing that's awful. It's the only ballot issue that's awful.
Unless you have a local ballot issue, state issue one is the only statewide issue you will find on your ballot. So it should be easy to recognize it and understand what you're dealing with. So overall, folks, it's horrible. It's not what it's sold to be. It is going to create more harm than good. And as far as treatment goes, nobody's going to get treated under this. But what's going to happen is that a lot of liberal causes are going to get funded under it.
Yeah, basically.
You can hear us. If you want to go back, you can listen to our previous program on our podcast that we did on issue one, the full hour that we did. Chuck, there's another issue that's not going to appear on the ballot, but it actually is going to impact the vote on Tuesday. And that issue is the steady progressive movement of what I would call a mass train of humanity that is wending its way up from the areas of Honduras and El Salvador toward the southern border of the United States. The liberal media calls it the migrant caravan. What we call it is a likely invasion force that has been ginned up by the same type of folks, the George Soros's of the world, the Mark Zuckerbergs, in order to try to, and I think what they were hoping to do is to force Trump to do something that looks so egregious to the American people, i.e. the media spins it that way, that it would impact the election on Tuesday. But you know what? The president, I think, has once again taken the lemons given to him by the liberals, and he's making lemonade out of them, or so it appears. Now, Chuck, on last count, there was not one, there's not two, but there are 3 groups of Latin American individuals who are moving toward our southern border. Obviously, the first group from Honduras started out, I think the number's 3,000 or 4,000, then you heard 7. Now you're hearing like 14,000 because they were joined by groups. I think there was another group, a third caravan is just supposedly started off from the country of El Salvador. If you follow the news reports, there's all kinds of interesting things happen. The main caravan, the northernmost caravan, group is in Mexico, and the Mexican government has been over backwards, I guess, Chuck, is a good way of saying it, providing health care and food and temporary shelters and things of that nature for the folks, and has even offered a number of them, the ability to stay in Mexico, and if they're fleeing from political racial persecution in Honduras or political persecution in Honduras, they've been offered to stay in Mexico, but they don't want to stay in Mexico because their goal is to come to the United States. Now, people have been moaning and groaning on the mainstream media because Trump has talked about mobilizing the military and sending troops, and he has been doing that, talking about now sending 15,000 troops to the southern border to keep the peace and to basically stop a mass wave of illegal immigration into the country. And
I think it's wise. And, you know, you and I have talked offline. And I said, you really want to twist the liberals' knickers into a bunch. You go down there and you set up stations all along the southern border for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. And you basically say, okay, if they want to come into the country, we're going to take them one at a time. We're going to process them through all of our you know, information we need to do. We're going to get them, see if they qualify to get an entry visa. We're going to check, like, their health status. We're going to check their felony records, their status there. We're going to do all the things that we do for anybody else who wants to enter this country legally. That would get the liberals' knickers in a bunch. And then you'd flesh them out. And, of course, we've seen a lot of them from the socialist progressives like Ocasio-Cortez, many of the others, the Hollywood types, you know, who all humanity is legal, blah blah blah. You have to have perfectly open borders for everybody.
The hyper bad argumentation, yeah.
The folks who basically just don't have the first clue. Let's just put it that way. And so you've got those, but then you know what? I just have to laugh because Trump is not a stupid man. Okay. And so what did he do at the beginning of this week? Well, he did an interview with an HBO series, I think it's called Axios, where he basically said that, oh, we've been looking at it, and I don't believe we need a constitutional amendment. I don't even believe we need an act of Congress, but I am going to, by executive order, end a little thing called birthright citizenship in the United States. Now, Chuck, you've done some backgrounding, I know. You want to explain to folks what that phrase birthright citizenship entails?
Well, what it goes to is the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. What it means is that if you're born inside the borders of the United States, then you are by right an American citizen. Now, how did we get, has it always been birthright citizenship? Well, gosh, no. Up until the 14th Amendment, citizenship of the United States was contingent upon citizenship of a state. In other words, citizenship criteria was set, except in naturalization, but citizenship criteria was set by the individual states. So the individual states might say, as a prerequisite of citizenship, you must do this and this and this and this. May have been served in the militia, may have been born in the state or a resident of the state for, you know, 5 years, 2 years, 1 year. For many years, when I first signed up to vote in the mid-70s, you had to be a resident for a year before you were eligible to vote in the state of Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Now what is it?
30 days.
30 days. It's really, really, really lax. And why was that? Well, you didn't get citizenship in a particular state until you had shown that you were going to be a permanent resident. Now, here's what's interesting. When I lived in Michigan, and I went to Michigan State University, do you know that university still require, you cannot claim state citizenship for purposes of tuition by simply moving to the state and setting up a permanent residence. I had to live in Michigan for a year, and I had to apply to be recognized as a citizen of Michigan for purposes of tuition, because I was paying out-of-state tuition for a year, even though my wife and I had moved there. She had a permanent job. We had a permanent residence. Didn't matter. Mm-hmm. What do you call that? You call that citizenship control, essentially.
Well, absolutely. And that has to be done.
Exactly. It does have to be done. It absolutely has to be done. Otherwise, you'd simply get overrun. And your entire society changes in the blink of an eye. That is why we control borders. We have to make sure that people, that one of the reasons we're having trouble with the creation of a welfare state is the fact that we have people who come here for the benefits, and there are politicians who recognize that and say, you, as if you vote for me, I will make sure that you continue to get your benefits. Now, we've got things going on. For instance, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate in Georgia has made statements that illegals will be part of the blue wave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's no surprise.
Yeah. How will illegals be part of the blue wave? By voting illegally. Registering and voting
exactly illegally.
I mean, that's the bottom line. So it's a tacit admission that goes on. The news media keeps telling us that that's not really a problem. Of course it's a problem. That's just a dumb thing to say. Do illegals register and vote? Of course they do. Why? Because there are people that go door to door. There's motor voter. If you go down just to get an ID at the state motor vehicle agency, where most states require you go get an ID, they will register you to vote. Do they ask to vet your citizenship papers when they do that? No, they ask you to sign a little piece and check a box that says, I'm a United States citizen.
Exactly.
So, yeah, are people who are not eligible registering to vote? Oh, you bet they are. Of course they are. Are they voting?
In droves.
They're. Why do you think busloads of, for instance, in Columbus, why do you think busloads of Somalis show up unable to speak English with people who basically walk them through the ballot or give them a piece of paper written in their with the instructions written in their native language on which buttons to push, and it's not a nonpartisan instruction.
Of course not.
And it's not just Somalis. It's all kinds of people of foreign extraction who are not citizens, should not be voting, and yet there they are. And I've known people who worked as poll workers who basically tried to challenge and were told if they challenged, they would be sent home and not allowed back as poll workers.
Well, that's not a surprise there either. But, you know, Chuck, this whole idea of birthright citizenship has been around, debated for a number of years. But it really generated, I mean, in the argument right now, and honestly, in one sense, as a constitutional teacher, I'm happy to have this debate come up.
Oh,
because
absolutely.
We're now talking about the Constitution and at least one of the amendments to the Constitution, which is the 14th Amendment. Now, what does the 14th Amendment have to say about it?
Well, okay, I'm calling up the 14th Amendment so I can quote it verbatim. So, this will take me a second. But basically what it says is that all persons born in the United States are citizens there and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are United States citizens.
Right, yes. All persons born or naturalized? Or naturalized doesn't appear in the amendment.
Yes, it does. Born or naturalized.
Okay, born or naturalized. Okay. So all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States. Oh, excuse me. Who are born or naturalized in the United States and are subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
Subject to the jurisdiction. That's the sticker right there.
Well, and of course, the argument in favor of birthright citizenship stems from the reading of the first part of the amendment, correct? And the last part.
Right.
Because the amendment's got two paragraphs. So the first part, all persons born in the United States are citizens. That's the argument for the hardcore progressive leftists that and we've heard the term anchor babies, where someone who comes into the country illegally will then either get pregnant or came in pregnant, has their child in the United States, that the child is automatically granted U.S. citizenship, and therefore that's an anchor for the illegal to stay in the country because they're here, and the U.S. citizen is dependent upon them. So that's that part of the argument. And, of course, then there's another part of the argument at the bottom, and you mentioned the whole idea of the states setting those standards for citizenship within the state. There's that second paragraph is a provision that basically says that the states can't
abridge
the right of citizenship to individuals who qualify under the first clause of the 14th Amendment. Now,
Chuck, when was the 14th Amendment adopted?
1866.
The previous 5 years? What had been going on?
Yeah, 1868. Well, the history of the 14th
Amendment. Well, in the previous decade, what had happened in this country in the previous decade?
Well, what happened was, of course, the you call it what you will, Civil War, War Between the States, War of Northern Aggression, War of Southern Independence. You call it what you will. That's what happened.
Okay, great. Yes, we had a war. And, well, depending on who you ask, that war was in part over the issue of slavery.
Yeah, so the purpose of the 14th Amendment was to prohibit those states that had recently been resubjected after the war between the states, the southern states, to keep those states from passing laws to not recognize the citizenship of African Americans.
Exactly.
In other words, in trying to fight the war by other means, at least in the North side. And so that was passed then. Now, of course, there were a series of cases that came up after that, one of the most famous called the Slaughterhouse Cases, and others, where this whole idea of citizenship was flushed out a little bit more.
So what you have here is the president is now talking. Like I said, he was on this program that's going to air actually tomorrow night, on Sunday night before the election, talking to a reporter about how he's looking at he's talked to his legal advisors, and he basically said, and I quote, it was always told to me that you needed a constitutional amendment. Guess what? You don't. He says, you can definitely do it with an act of Congress, but now they're saying I can do it just with an executive order, unquote. Now, the thing that people, you know, are complaining about is, oh, well, now they're worried about how overreaching the presidency is. Now, Barack Obama did hundreds of executive
orders, gosh,
in his time, and the left was perfectly fine with him changing the Constitution by executive order. But when Trump talks about it, they start screaming bloody murder. Now, as we talked about, everything hinges around a phrase in the 14th Amendment, and that phrase is subject to the jurisdiction thereof, which is set apart in the amendment specifically to make a point. And I get the point that he's trying to make, because when he's talking about ending birthright citizenship, what he's talking about is he's going to try to cut off a way in which illegal aliens try to stay in the country. Because this would affect, Chuck, are those who are illegally and underhandedly residing in this country. Because the words subject to the jurisdiction thereof means that you are legally bound to this country's laws.
Right.
Now, the only people who are legally bound to this country's laws as foreign nationals are resident aliens who have taken up residence here and who have done so through the proper channels of immigration and going through ICE or whoever to establish their residency and get what we call their visa or their green cards in order to say that they are a semi-permanent resident of the United States, even though their citizenship is with another country.
Think about it this way, real quick. A person, anybody who's in anybody's country is subject to their law, but they're not necessarily subject to their jurisdiction. Now, what do I mean by that? If I go to England, and I'm accused of a crime, even whether I did it or not, I can appeal directly for support from the United States Embassy. Why can I do that? Because I am subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Now, I'm inside a foreign jurisdiction, but I can seek diplomatic help inside of another country because I am subject to that country's jurisdiction. And what is being said here is that a person who simply comes in, is visiting and has not taken up a residence, an official residence established by law, is not subject to the jurisdiction of the country. They are subject to the laws of the country, but not the jurisdiction.
That is correct. Absolutely correct. And Chuck, okay, that is, and again, I get it. I get it from the president's viewpoint here. As a matter of fact, he goes on and says something else that a lot of people are now poo-pooing, saying, oh, well, you know, there's another one of the fake facts from Donald Trump. And this is what he said on the interview. He said, quote, "We're the only country in the world where a person comes in and has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States with all those benefits," unquote. Chuck, what was wrong with that sentence,
well,
that comment?
It's not really true. He's not following.
But it is true. Listen carefully to what he said. He said, "We're the only country in the world where a person comes in and has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States." Because if that person went into any other country and had a baby and they had birthright citizenship, they'd be a citizen of that country.
Well, that's true.
He's technically right. He's technically dead on one point. But, of course, people argue, oh, there are 30 countries that have birthright citizenship, blah, 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 blah. Well, okay, yeah, right. But, you know, the point is he was making a different point. He's saying it's our country. I don't care about any other countries. And we're the only country in the world where somebody comes in and illegally and has a baby, all of a sudden that baby becomes a U.S. citizen. And the way he reads the 14th Amendment and his advisors are reading it, they don't believe that that's accurate. And I'm right there with them, Chuck. I don't believe it's accurate either. Because
I don't either.
I believe that those individuals are not subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And you and I have talked about this when we teach our Constitution courses. And folks, if you're interested in having a course fired up for you on Institute on the Constitution, it's a 12-week, 2 hours once a week on an evening. We come in and we teach the history, the background, the biblical foundations, and the applications of the Constitution of the United States. It's a great class. Chuck and I are both instructors, and we'd be happy to teach it. You just need to find a location and be able to generate about a dozen people to come and take the class. And we will come, and Chuck and I travel far afield to do these courses.
That's right.
But during the course of our teaching, we talk about the idea of, and this is in context to another part of the Constitution, i.e. the natural-born citizen phrase, found in the qualifications for those who can be president of the United States. And Chuck, as we say, you know, that the founders looked to historical sources, including Emmerich de Vattel and his writings. Was an international scholar and written had a good definitions of what a natural born citizen was. And as we unpack that, that a natural-born citizen is someone who is born whose father is a citizen of the country, not just the mother, and especially not someone who's a foreign national who comes in and happens to give birth while on U.S. soil.
There's actually another provision that is born of a father who has been naturalized.
Or naturalized. That's right.
Right.
Well, and naturalization is a formal process, legal process of becoming a naturalized citizen of this country. So if you take that as a frame, now again, we know the 14th Amendment was not written until the late 1860s.
Yes. 1868.
Yeah. 1868, the late 1860s. I want to make sure I didn't misspeak there. And we know that, obviously, by that time, we had gone through upheavals and a war, and what we had was a shift in the philosophy. And, Chuck, we talk about this, too, in the class, of how if you look at the amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, which actually is the 10 plus the 27th, because that was part of the original 12 amendments that were offered to
right.
the Continental Congress, who then, you know, took 10 of them, and two of them were put aside, but one of them then became a part of the Constitution during the 20th century.
That's right. Number 27 was ratified around 200 years after it was submitted.
200 years after it was submitted. But those amendments, and going up to about the 12th Amendment,
all of those amendments had one thing in common philosophically. They all restricted, reduced, limited, or put in chains the power of the federal government over the people. Okay, they were all limits of power. Congress shall make no law, as you remember from the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law. The rights of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay, those were all protections of power, keeping power from centralizing to the federal government. But after the war between the states, Chuck, what we had was a shift of philosophies. One would say that we basically had a secondary revolution that was quiet, and it was hidden in on the heels of a internal conflict called the Civil War.
Yeah.
And what you had was the Reconstruction Congress, who decided to subjugate the Southern states for what they considered to be a horrible breach of decorum in persecuting the war. And they started writing amendments that then basically restricted the powers of the states and enabled the federal government to take more control. And you see phrases like Congress shall have the appropriate power or jurisdiction to enforce this measure by appropriate laws, you know. So in other words, basically from the 13th Amendment on to the 26th, not the 27th, because it was part of the original philosophy of the Bill of Rights, you have a situation now that when we introduce amendments, they're all amendments that basically restrict, reduce, control, or lock down the powers of the sovereign states and give it to the federal government. And the 14th is no exception. And so, you know, you have this situation where the states have had their power taken away from them. Well, Chuck, I think it's very interesting with this particular issue that, okay, and I'm just going to say it right out. It's not a racist thing. It's not a, radical white supremacist nationalistic thing for the president to be doing this. I honestly believe that, A, he sees it as a problem, but I think he sees it more as an opportunity for something else. Because as we've been thinking about this and talking about coming on and doing this program, and I've been reading through some of this stuff, a thought occurred to me. And I think it's a very interesting, and I'm going to put it out there, and you can poo-poo it if you want to, or our listeners can too.
Thanks.
But I believe that Trump is smarter than the average bear with this. And I think what he's doing with the birthright citizenship issue is he is getting the left to lay the groundwork for him to get rid of DACA, to get rid of amnesty, to get rid of everything regarding illegal immigration. Now, why do I say that? The 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
Because he's going to say that, okay, if you guys are going to, if you want to hold your argument and fight me in court over ending birthright citizenship because you believe that the 14th Amendment allows it, then I'm going to come back and argue that the 14th Amendment also allows us to have ICE to round up illegal aliens and to kick them out of the country because they are not subject to the jurisdiction thereof. I think he's going in for a kill. You're gonna push. Go ahead.
No, I'm not gonna push back because I think This is the way the guy works. You've pointed out many times, and I've nodded in agreement. While the left is, and a lot of the Republicans are playing checkers, he's playing chess.
Absolutely. Yeah, he's playing a high level. You know what? Have you ever seen those three-dimensional chess games?
Yes.
I forget what the specific name of it's called. I keep thinking Othello, but that's the little thing with the tiles.
With the tiles.
But there's three-dimensional chess where you're playing three boards. And they're all offset, and they're so you're playing not horizontal and vertical, but diagonal and up and down from one board to the other.
Well, that's a Star Trek. That's a Star Trek thing. It was shown on Star Trek, and somebody actually popped up with board and some rules.
Yeah, figured out how to do it.
Yes, exactly. Developed an entirely different game out of it. So yeah.
Yeah. So he's playing this game. And the left is going to play right into his hands, I believe, because he's floating this out. First of all, I think he's right. I think he might be able to do this by executive order. Now, he says that Congress has never acted on this on the 14th Amendment. Now, somebody would argue that 1952, that yes, they did. And, you know, we looked that up, Chuck.
It's, yes, we did.
Title 8 of the United States Code about immigration and naturalization.
Right.
But I still think he's writing that, too, because I think if you read that carefully, what he's doing is he's setting the framework to get them to say that so he can say, yes, you're right. And if you look at the provisions in there, there's nothing in there that says someone who comes into this country illegally has any rights. He's taking away a foundational prop that the left has been using against Republicans in Congress now for a number of years. And I think he's going to do it so masterfully that they'll never be able to use it again. Maybe I'm reading too much into this. That's no, fine. If
Barry,
I am.
Every time, you know, we've talked about this, and I've said a couple times on a couple different things, I think you're reading too much into that. And every time I've been wrong. So
okay.
So it's not a bad thing that you've come up with this. I don't think you're incorrect.
Well, you know, and I do this not only just because of the 14th Amendment. I'm looking at what the courts have done over time with this. And, you know, one of the big decisions that we have to look at, and of course now he has two members of the Supreme Court on, and that is an 82 decision of the Supreme Court that said that even if a person enters the country illegally, the person is within U.S. jurisdiction and is subject to the full range of obligations imposed by the state civil and criminal laws. Okay, but that's not being subject to the jurisdiction because there are provisions that allow delegates, diplomats, emissaries, none of them are under the criminal. And we know that for a fact because when they commit a crime, they run back to the embassy and they're granted immunity. And basically it says until he leaves the jurisdiction, either voluntarily or involuntarily. And this is this decision from the Supreme Court back in 82. Okay, let me get back down to it because this thing refreshes and then jumps around.
Yeah, I understand.
Until he leaves the jurisdiction, either voluntary or involuntary, in accordance with the Constitution and laws of the United States, he is entitled to equal protection of the laws that a state may choose to establish. Okay, if he leaves the jurisdiction involuntarily in accordance with the Constitution and laws of the United States, I think that's where Trump's got him. Well, I think they're studying this, and they've figured this out.
Well, if you dig around on Numbers USA, they have Supreme Court opinions about birthright citizenship and the 14th Amendment.
Yep.
And this one caught my eye. There have been later rulings that dealt with birthright citizenship for legal immigrants, such as the case in the United States versus Wong Kim Ark.
I just pulled that up. And I are both going to the same thing.
In 1898, the case is often cited by the supporters of birthright citizenship, but the court clearly ruled that the defendant's parents were legal permanent residents of the United States at the time of his birth.
Permanent residence.
Exactly. And not once was the legal status of the parents or the defendant ever questioned.
Bingo.
And here is the language from the Supreme Court ruling. A child born in the United States of parents of Chinese descent who at the time of his birth are subjects of the Emperor of China but have a permanent domicile and residents in the United States and are not employed in any diplomatic or official capacity under the Emperor of China becomes at the time of his birth a citizen of the United States.
Which would fit with the 14th Amendment.
Exactly. It fits.
Because even though they are foreign nationals, they have come in the country legally. They have gone through the process and they've established permanent residency, i.e., they received their visas or the late 1800s version of visas. They are here legally. And that is the entire spin difference. Yes. Between what the progressive left is screaming about birthright citizenship and actual citizenship of the United States.
Well, it's legally and permanently.
Yep.
And that's the bottom line.
And no individual who has entered this country illegally and thus broken our laws to get in the country can be here legally and permanently.
Well, that's right.
And so I think the president is dead right on this, and using these precedents, both from 1898 and from 1982, I believe that he's got a fairly valid argument here. And it would take an act of Congress to change that.
Well, that's why Donald Trump was quoted as saying, when frankly he heard what had been said by Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, who was being very disparaging of Donald Trump on this issue, said basically Paul Ryan should stick to trying to maintain his majority in the House and stop speaking out on birthright citizenship, of which he knows nothing.
Right, in which he knows nothing.
Now, it's typical Donald Trump bombast, but he's not far off the mark. And in fact, that is what Paul Ryan should have been doing. In fact, Paul Ryan, when he decided not to run for re-election, should have stepped out of the speakership and did not, held on to it, because it's the job of the speaker to be the front man to get Republicans re-elected. How can you be the front man on trying to get Republicans re-elected when you have quit? There, I find a major problem with that.
So, yeah, Chuck, I think you're absolutely right.
Well, as we're running out of time today and we're having technical difficulties, so ladies and gentlemen, if you notice this sounds a little funny, it's because we've had nothing but technical difficulties all day. We've been trying to make this recording all day. And the weather, it is fall time in Ohio, so what are we getting? We're getting color-destroying rain. In other words, all the leaves are being washed off the trees. But that being said, you know, this birthright citizenship being guaranteed by the United States Constitution, that there is an open question about that. And there are Supreme Court precedents that said, nope, not so fast. And I would like to find someone who has done a history to find out when the thinking about this changed. Because it did change sometime in our history, sometime between the end of the 19th century and sometime into the 20th, because birthright citizenship has always not been considered. In fact, the one of the persons who penned the 14th Amendment said directly that this was the purpose of the amendment was not to guarantee immigrants the right to call their children citizens. That wasn't the purpose. And he stated specifically what the purpose was. It was to ensure the rights of men and women born in slavery and ensure them their citizenship rights, because there were southern states who were denying them full citizenship on the basis that they were born in a state of servitude. Of all the terrible logic that you can imagine, this is one of those things that it had to be just terrible at the time. And if you know the history of the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment non-ratification was one of the reasons that the southern states were removed once again from legal state status and put into Reconstruction. And they were in Reconstruction for 10 years, from 1867 until 1877, and that was a military occupation and a military governing of the South. So you can see that this was a hot button issue at the time, but the fact is the 14th Amendment was never designed to give birthright citizenship, a blanket birthright citizenship. And the Supreme Court says that there are circumstances under which it can happen and circumstances under which it can't happen. So that being said, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.